This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
Discover more of our shows at soundrebel.co.uk.
Hi, welcome to the Keep Real podcast, the show that explores real stories from very real people with a focus on mental health. I'm Kim, and today we have reeled in the wonderful Freddie Bennett, host of Over the Influence podcast, world's fastest fisherman, and all-round action man. Hello. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me. I am very excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So, yeah. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name's Freddie. I'm 38. I live in Liverpool with, I've got two boys and I'm married to Sarah. And it's been quite a journey for me. And I think, you know, you talk about fisherman's tales and this has certainly been a different tale.
Okay.
I grew up in quite a different upbringing, should we say, with lots of conflict and travel going around to my house. I then went through, school and university. It was important for me to, I saw education as a way to escape. So I tried to work hard, get my exams, not because I was particularly intelligent, but just because I tried to get my head down and get my work done. Yeah, definitely. Then I sort of thought, well, I'll do what I'm supposed to do. And I went to university and I got a very respectable corporate job and had to become this corporate person that I thought I wanted to be. But as the years grew on, I became less and less happy. And it's all good fun when you're in your early 20s, at the time I was living in London. But at the time also, the nights got later and the waistlines got tighter and the lunches got longer and the hangovers got worse. And then I realised I was becoming more and more disillusioned and unhappy.
Okay, so where did that start for you then? What was your kind of trigger points? What happened there?
And it's interesting you say that because I always thought my trigger points were, you know, when I always call it a quarter life crisis.
Yeah.
When they say I'm 38 now, let's say when I was 25, I thought it started to happen then. But only a few weeks ago, I found one of my old diaries when I was a teenager. You never want to read a 14-year-old teenage boy's diary, that's for sure.
You find out all sorts of different things.
I know, definitely. Oh, yeah. I was quite worried when I read it, but I obviously was not one of the cool kids at school because when all the other kids were hanging out and playing football, I was in my bedroom writing my diary.
Yeah, I love that. That's great.
Journaling's cool now. It wasn't so cool back in 1992. Mm-hmm. And I noticed this phrase I kept on using in this diary. I would have been, say, 14, 15 years old at the time.
Okay.
I kept on reading the word stressed.
Right, okay. And I don't even remember writing. That's such a young age as well.
And I had things like New Year's resolutions. Don't be as stressed. Oh, I was really stressed today. Don't get stressed at this person, this situation. So that's when I realised, actually, I think it started a lot younger than I thought it did. I mean, I said I grew up in quite a different house. One little story is that my parents didn't have much money and they came from a background of wheeler dealers. So my dad's dad used to be in horses in Birmingham, and it turned out he sold horses to a bunch of gentlemen that are today known as the Peaky Blinders.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it was that kind of household we had, and my dad was into computers. This was like in the late 80s, and my dad started working with this guy called Steve, and Steve was in America. And so one day my dad walked in and he was like, right, we're going to America now.
Oh,
tomorrow.
Wow.
Steve turned out to be Steve Jobs. And it's fair to say with the way my family was, my dad and Steve fell out. Obviously, it worked out a lot better for Steve than it did for my dad, because we certainly weren't driving around in Lamborghinis or anything.
Oh my gosh.
And so I, as a child, I've been ripped out of this existence in England, landed in America. And you know what? I loved it. I loved the schools. I loved the people. I felt like I could be myself. I was so happy.
So then, it wasn't as stressed then?
No, it wasn't as stressed.
In your journal?
No, exactly. I was actually playing with friends. I didn't have to just have imaginary friends all the time.
Yeah.
And then I remember we came back to the UK for a summer holiday. And while we were there, my dad said, oh, by the way, I've been fired. You're never going back to America again. So you have this second time. This time I didn't even get to say goodbye to my friends. Even to this day, I don't know if they knew what happened to me. I literally disappeared from their lives one day. And then, so I was in this existence where we had no house, no money, no jobs, obviously.
no jobs.
Steve was off building his fortune. And and that's why I started to become more anxious as a child. And I craved stability. And my parents were drinking heavily. They were breaking up. They were getting back together, breaking up again.
That's hard to even just watch.
I know,
and
definitely.
Be that observing yeah. child within that.
Exactly. And I was only child. I mean, my mum was my dad's third wife. And so he managed to get through wives quite quickly.
Right.
And it was a very disruptive environment. But I just wanted stability and normality. And we had a few instances where, you know, my parents would hide behind the sofa and make me answer the door when the bailiffs came around.
Right, okay.
Because they knew...
That's a lot of responsibility.
It is, yeah. Definitely, for a child when I didn't know what was happening. Yeah. I just knew that this scary man was on the front door and I was to tell him that mummy and daddy weren't hiding behind the sofa.
Yeah.
And it's a lot to bring on. And that's why I think I had this... The first inkling of some sort of mindset that I could potentially push myself and change my circumstances. And I saw education as my way of escaping. So I certainly wasn't particularly intelligent by any means. But yeah. I was, hence being not the cool kid at school, I'd use my lunch times in the library, working yeah. hard and getting my exams and getting to university.
And so that went on through university. And then when did you get your job? Was that straight away?
Yeah, straight after university. Well? So I joined... a big global corporate firm on their graduate program.
And as you straight out
of university. So I was one of those like students. I had my job lined up. Yeah. I had my offer.
So you got that stability there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I had that stability and it was fantastic. And I went to uni in Manchester and moved down to London to start my job. And I was like a kid in a candy shop.
I was just about to say, what was that transition like?
It sounds, yeah. I mean, at the time it felt so grown up. I mean, I would have been, probably 23 then or something. Yeah. This was back in 2004. At the time, it felt very grown up, you know, polishing my shoes and wearing my suit and walking on the tube and everything and thinking, yeah, I'm a proper grown yeah. up. I'm a worker. I get paid. I remember I'd get home every night and I'd be like, I got paid for today. And now I, you know, there's no like, one
what
telling
do I do
me what
with
to
myself?
Do.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
no uni work to do. No, like, no essays to not do and no reading to pretend you've done. And it was amazing.
So what did you do in that downtime instead of going to the library and things like that? What was your downtime within that corporate world?
I generally went to the pub, which Ooh. Was great fun at the time. Yeah. But looking back, the start of a slippery slope. And I think it's when I was a teenager and a student as well, they always say you should find something that you're passionate about and that you're good at. And for me, that was drinking.
Yeah.
I found out very early, I was very good at drinking.
Yeah.
And I was very passionate about it. And in this corporate world, deep down, I really felt like an imposter. It was one of those environments. It was in the city. It was London. I'll try and say it in a very nice way. There are a lot of people there where mummy and daddy said, go on, go and
right, okay,
my mate's got you a job now and go and be an accountant or go and be a lawyer. And they'd be like, oh, okay. And it was great for me to get paid some money every month, but that was all my money. I always had some financial yeah. pressures, but there are a lot of people there that came from a different world.
Different backgrounds.
Yeah, that yeah. came from the rugby clubs and the polo clubs and the yeah. private schools and the private jets and everything else.
Which are friends that are completely different to what you've been brought
yeah,
with as well.
Exactly.
So it's difficult to navigate that.
And it was really that, exactly. And I felt like an imposter and I felt like I didn't deserve to be there, to be honest. And even yeah. though I'd got the qualifications and I'd done the interviews and I'd got the job. I mean,
still wasn't convinced.
No, definitely. I got a geography degree, which
yeah.
I'm always a secret geographer.
Love
and,
it.
And you'd be sat there being introduced to Raphael, who went to Oxford and got a first in business and economics.
Yeah.
And I was there saying, yeah, 2-1 geography.
And yeah, it's hard. Like you just compare yourselves so yeah. much to everybody else that
exactly.
have different upbringings. You're always
I know.
Comparing.
And
so was the main thing to do after work was that to go straight to the pub then?
Yeah, it was a big drinking environment. It's very much a work hard, play hard culture. If you can imagine, if anyone watches The Apprentice, it was a bit
like
that. And I was not one of those people, I'd like to think. But maybe that's why I felt like such a fish out of water. But yeah,
love
it
the
was.
Pun there.
yeah. And it was always about. You know, drinks with your team or drinks with your clients or drinks with your boss, or then it would be Thursday. And we'd always say Thursday is the new Friday.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
it would be a badge of honor. You know, who could get the drunkest at night or the most drunk and then be at work the next day and be at their desk at 8 o'clock in the morning.
So was that, did you repeat that cycle? Like, were you drinking every night? When did it start becoming an issue?
It was fairly early on. I think with me, it was binge drinking that was the problem. So because I was so nervous, I felt like such an imposter, I tried to create a bit of a persona for myself. So yeah. I was quite early in my corporate career. I was christened Funtime Freddy.
Really? Wow. That's a strong name to live up to.
I know. Yeah. And it really was. And that was the way I dealt with anxiety. It was, if I was in a situation where I felt a bit worse than everyone else and a bit inferior,
you'd switch it on.
Exactly. Yeah. And I knew I was good at drinking. And it's when you're in an environment where you don't think you're as good as everyone else, then you think, well, what have I got going for me? I was like, yeah. I can get a party started. Mm. So I would always be there. I'd be the first at the bar, the first person to buy shots, the first person to say, let's go to a nightclub and let's carry on. You know, I had a few instances where, especially in the early days when this was more, you know, wasn't frowned upon, you know, sometimes I'd go out, I'd get maybe an hour's sleep and then try and be back at work still drunk.
Holy moly. Yeah.
I always now certainly take responsibility for my actions and I don't blame anyone or anything. But in this environment, it wasn't looked on as a bad thing. You know, if anything, I'd get a few pats on the back and I made a name for myself.
Yeah.
When you're in this competitive corporate environment and everyone's, you know, stabbing each other in the back. And I had a couple of nights out and, you know, the next morning you get the whole thing where you walk in and your boss is like, yay, legend.
Like high-fiving,
yeah,
high five and you pat.
You were such great fun last night. And I thought, oh, hang on.
So you get rewarded for the behaviour.
Exactly. You get a little dopamine buzz and you get rewarded. And all of a sudden people know who you are. And it is a bit like being the new kid at school or the new kid at university. And all of a sudden, like, people say, oh, you need to have Freddie on a night out. And at the time I loved it. I wasn't realising that it's actually better to get recognised and rewarded for doing a great job or for helping someone and doing something else. I just thought, people like me and I'm accepted and I've got this bit of stability now where...
Yeah, if that's what it takes to receive that high-fiving culture, then you're going to keep doing it.
Even though everything in your body is telling you and your mind is saying, don't do this, I don't want to do it, just go and get some rest. But I was like, no, you know, it's powering
just
through.
Just powering through.
Exactly.
So what happened then? Like, when was that kind of trigger point for you to be like, I can't do this anymore?
So it was... I recognised it deep down, I'd say, for about a year when I had a few instances at work where it switched from being all good fun and laughs to a lot darker.
Yeah.
I won't fill the podcast with all my skeletons in my closet because there isn't enough time. But yeah, there are a few things when it switches from being hilarious, legend, banter, all that annoying stuff to being a bit like, something's not right here. You know, we'd all be away in a hotel for a team building event, and I managed to lock myself out of my hotel room at 3 a.m.
Oh gosh,
naked.
Oh, right, okay, that changes everything.
Yeah, it does. And I remember I'd gone to the bathroom and chosen the wrong door, and then by the time I realised, and I didn't have my contact lenses in on my glasses, so I couldn't see
even
anything.
Worse. Yeah.
And I could hear people walking around the corridors, and I was like, that could be my boss, but I can't see them. And so I managed to get myself into my room. There were flights that were missed. There was a time in New York when I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and a drug dealer ended up putting a loaded gun to my head.
Oh my gosh.
And then he put a gun to my head. He marched me to a cash point and he said, take all your money out from the cash point, otherwise, well, I won't say that what he actually said.
Yeah.
Politely, he said, otherwise I'm going to kill you. And because I was obviously a bit drunk at the time, it made perfect sense for me to do the whole, oh, look over there, what's that? And he turned.
Oh my gosh, that's like the other thing that I would do.
Yeah.
I'd be like, yeah, take all my money, take it all.
That's what I should have done. And at that time, and yeah, it was one of the most horrible, traumatic experiences of my life. And that should have been the turning point for me to say, you need
this
to change.
This can't happen anymore.
But we tell ourselves stories. We tell ourselves what we want to hear. And I said, it was just a bit of bad luck. It happens to everyone. And I drank later that day and I drank that night and I carried on going. Because I told myself, you've had a traumatic experience. What do you do? Have a drink. But then the real turning point was... And it was funny because it was the day I got promoted. And
In
this corporate world, the promotion was such a big deal. And I'd been trying for it for 18 months. I'd been missing out on time with my friends. I'd been neglecting my family. I'd been putting myself under crazy immense stress and pressure. And I got it. And then I remember it was obviously at a drinks event to celebrate. And I was doing what I do best and drinking and celebrating. But then for some reason, some... I can only describe it as darkness coming over me. And it was, because I remember it was a summer's evening and I was obviously still up at 3 or 4 in the morning, and it should have been getting light. And I was just sat on the pavement with a drink beside me, and it just felt so dark and so forbidding. And I felt that I was in a spiral. And I remember just thinking, my life is out of control, and I couldn't see a way out. And that's the moment where I thought, well, maybe there is a way out. But that means going to your hotel room and exiting the building from the roof and not from the floor. And that's what I thought, maybe sort of taking drastic action and finding a permanent solution to this temporary problem would be the way to go. But on that night, I drunkenly called the Samaritans and rambled on to them for about an hour. Probably very boring for the first one phone. And
that helps.
It did help.
They were really good on the phone.
Yeah, and they were really good on the phone. And there were a few instances after that where I had to have them on speed dial. But, and to be fair, say much that this corporate job where I felt like a fish out of water and I didn't really enjoy it, but my company were supportive, and they put me into therapy and counselling
straight away.
Pretty much, yeah. It's,
that's fantastic.
It is really good, yeah. And I think that is a really good thing about a lot of businesses in the UK at the moment, that they are starting at least to take mental health seriously. And much as we don't like the big bad corporate world sometimes, certainly to be fair to my businesses, I know a lot of others are the same. When you put your hand up and you say, I need help with my mental health, then a whole machine that you didn't know existed suddenly
just comes up.
Comes alive, and it helped me. They were very conscious about not putting me under too much stress and too much pressure. But then it's difficult because I was in this environment that was stressed, that was competitive. So I'd say within 9 to 12 months, I was pretty much back to where I was. But then I started to realize that life can be short and that life can be precious. And it was my dad that taught me that. But the only problem is he had to teach me that lesson by dying quite suddenly.
Right. Okay. So was that while you were at your corporate job?
Yeah, it was. And it was, it was just like any other day. I'd spoken to him the day before. I was sat in my corporate job, probably a bit hungover, of just eating a sandwich, looking at a computer, a spreadsheet that had crashed. And I remember saying in a very naive, very arrogant way, like, oh, I can't believe this spreadsheet is broken. My life could not get any worse right now.
Yeah.
And then the phone rang. And you know, my dad had been taken to hospital that morning. And so to cut a long and painful story short, I had to jump in my car with nothing, just with my suit and my laptop bag, drive 300 miles to near Bristol where he was. And then I had that day that we all dread, where at lunchtime it was a normal, hungover, annoyed, boring day. And by dinner time that evening, I kissed him on the forehead and I watched him die.
Gosh, that is such a transition period.
Definitely. And you know, my dad was a very heavy drinker. He always had been. And again, in the Hollywood version of the story, then that was the moment. And I walk out of the hospital and I say, right, I've learnt my lesson. I'm going to live my life differently. The Freddie version was a lot different. And I had that crash course in life being short and life being precious. But then I took it the other way. And I said, you know, YOLO, like you only live once and no
living
regrets.
Living up to the name that you've
built. Yep, exactly. Live for the moment. So if anything, I partied harder. I went out more. I drank even more because I was there saying, I don't want any regrets in life. I want to do all, and I saw that as never saying no to a night out or a drink. But then I was browsing on the internet and I saw something that I toyed with every now and again in terms of an activity. And it was just the title, The World's Toughest Ultramarathon.
That is quite the title
it
to
was.
Look up.
It was. And I'd always, it was this race, this magical race that had been happening for the last 20 years. And so that's why I signed up. And 18 months later, I was standing in the middle of the Sahara Desert in 55 degree heat.
Ridiculous.
Getting ready to run 200 miles, which is the equivalent of 6 marathons in 5 days.
Oh my God.
And this race is called the Marathon du Sable, and that's why it's called the world's toughest, because the heat, you're in an environment that's designed to kill you. Water.
That's a lot against you as well.
Water's rationed. Yeah. And you have to carry all your own food and equipment on your back. So it's not like
it's so extreme compared to everything that you've ever done.
It was so different, and it was 56 miles non-stop. And
I can't imagine doing like 5 miles. No, 56,
definitely not. And I wasn't an athlete. I'd done a couple of marathons by that stage, but nothing further. And being in that environment, You know, I went all day and all through the night, and being in the middle of the desert, literally the only person for miles around in darkness.
That's terrifying.
It is. And there's a billion stars in the sky. You could see the satellites going overhead. It was so clear.
So what was that like finishing?
It was amazing. And this race was brutal. So I said, I had that 56 miler when you're weeing blood, lost in the desert, crossed the finish line that
day.
So
the weeing blood situation, what happened
I think my kidneys were failing.
Yeah, that sounds quite the kidney problem.
This race had some funny rules. Firstly, there were two camels at the back. And when the runners start running every day, and you've got all the media helicopters buzzing over your head, and it's all like, I was going to say there were crowds, but there was no one. But like
in the Sahara Desert.
All the marshals were like playing music, and it's all like, you feel like a celebrity.
Yeah.
But they start two camels at the same time, and thankfully camels walk quite slowly. But the rule is, if the camels catch you, then you're out.
Right, okay.
And the other rule is, everyone's allowed one intravenous drip. And if you have two, then they probably are going to chuck you out of the race.
Oh my gosh,
right. So I got my intravenous drip. And because this race is so brutal, I went through all of that. They had to go to bed, get my drip, wake up the next morning, run a marathon.
Oh, wow.
And that's why it was just relentless. Yeah. And you have to just to pick yourself up again.
That mindset has got to be so powerful. And just keep going.
And that's what I had to do. I just had to keep going. And it was this whole concept of I had to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. I had just to accept my situation. I had to accept there were things that I couldn't control. In fact, almost everything I couldn't control. I couldn't control the temperature or the fact that I had to run through 10 kilometers of sand dunes.
Gosh.
Or climb up a sand dune that was a kilometer high. I had to just say, all I can control right now is my mindset, and I can decide whether I'm going to let this beat me or whether I'm going to beat it. And I don't mean that in a macho way at all, in terms of like it's a battle that you must overcome.
Yeah.
But I can decide now whether I'm going to say I've had enough, or I can decide how far I'm going to go. And I always said that I was never going to quit the race. So if I didn't make it, if I got too unwell, or if I collapsed or passed out, or if the doctors pulled me out, then that was fine. But I promised my children, I promised myself that I would never quit. And then if I hadn't have made it, at least I can know that I gave it everything.
Yeah.
And I gave it my best. And then say I crossed the finish line, and it was amazing.
I'd just cry.
I think I did. I know there's a picture where I literally fell to my knees and I punched the sky, and the fact that I'd gone from being this overweight, lost soul to completing this crazy race. And that's when, say, I completed that goal.
What happened after the marathon and you got back to normal? What happened with the drinking?
So I got back to normal and then started slipping back into old patterns, going out once a week, then twice a week, then three times a week. And I could feel my mental health going again. And I say it was the story through the desert is a story that everyone wants to hear. So there's always someone that's willing to buy you a drink and hear your story about 200 miles through Sahara.
Yeah.
So I loved it. It was great. I could always tell that story. But then I remember it was the 8th of March, 2019. And it was a Wednesday night. I think there'd been some football on that I'd been watching, and had some drinks in the bar with my friends, and then they all went to bed. I stayed up having some more drinks, and then I thought I'll go and find a different bar. And then I ended up again getting back to my hotel room at 4 a.m.
Hopefully not naked this time.
No, I wasn't naked. I'd managed by this stage to actually keep my clothes
contact
on.
Lenses.
I think I probably had one so that's at least
improvement.
Halfway there.
Yeah,
definitely. And I woke up the next morning and I thought, what are you doing to yourself? And because 2019, so my dad died in 2018, did the race. 2019, I always told myself it was going to be a big year for me. And I wasn't getting any younger. I was 36, turning 37. I still had the same insecurities, the same feeling of being an imposter, still stuck in this corporate life that I didn't really want to be in. And all the feelings from my dad dying were still there around, I don't want to spend the next 30 years doing a job that I hate, moaning about it, living in a box, going to work in a box, to work in a box, to go back home to a box. Then one day you're going to be in a box dead, thinking, where did my life go? I've just lived someone else's dream. I've made someone else richer. And now I've got my pension that may or may not be there. And then that's it. And then you die. And that's it. And I didn't want that life so badly. And I'd set all the New Year's resolutions, made myself the promises. But then it was March And I thought, what are you doing? You're 3 months through the year. You've done your crazy desert race. But here I am, still in the bars, still doing the job I hate.
In your boxes.
In my boxes, exactly. And again, this phrase came back to me about if you want the things you've never had before, you've got to do the things you've never done before. And that's where I thought, I need to take a break from alcohol. And that was...
a big decision in a corporate world. Yeah.
It was. And I knew that... And looking back, I knew for years that that's the thing I had to do. But I always told myself a story that it wasn't...
It was your comfort.
Yeah, it was my comfort. And yeah. It wasn't the drinking, it was the economy or the fact that my boss was an idiot or that someone didn't understand me. Or I'd always blame my situations. And I had to look inwards and say, this is something that is, you know... My life wasn't terrible at that stage by any extent, but it was certainly not making my life better. And I thought it was literally... I woke up, this way it's like a Hollywood story. I woke up one day and I said, enough is enough. So I decided to take a break from alcohol, and originally it was going to be 90 days, which was tough.
That's a long time, especially with how much you were drinking.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So I was 36, then 37. You know, I hadn't gone 90 days without drinking since I was 16 years old. So you talk about comfort and behaviours and how everything in our society is designed around alcohol.
Yeah,
we drink when we're happy, when we're sad, to celebrate, to commiserate. And I thought, I'm going to have to be a rebel, and because I can be quite rebellious and like to do different things.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, I have to think of this differently and don't think about it as trying to give something up. And I knew if I thought about it as a like willpower or trying to beat the demons or anything else, it wouldn't work, because I tried to quit 1,000 times before.
Yeah.
Every Sunday morning, I'd be there saying,
I'm done now, that's it.
That's it. No, yeah. We've all been there, like, I am never drinking again.
Yeah.
Oh, glass of wine, why not?
Oh, yeah.
And this thought, no, And the way I was able to crack it was by looking at that life that I wanted so badly in terms of making my dreams come true and making my family so proud and loving who I was and this amazing life I designed for myself. And I said, if I want to get that life, then I have to leave this life. And to leave this life, I have to stop drinking for a while.
Yeah.
And once I made that connection, it was easier. But still, you know, I remember, I think it was day one or day two of quitting alcohol. And
it starts kicking in,
I bet. Yeah, it starts kicking in. And it was the first Friday of being alcohol free. And I had to go help out at my little boy's school disco. And it was for 6-year-old kids in the school, but there was a bar there.
Because
in our Western society, yeah, great. Because in our Western society, that's cool having a bar in a kid's school during a kid's disco. And because obviously the parents knew who I was because I created this personality, they were like, oh, Freddie, you can man the bar. You'll be good at that.
Yeah.
Fun Freddie will be there. And they were like, obviously, help yourself to some drinks as well. And I was like, right, again, this is a crossroad. I can either just, this can be one of those thousands of times where I say, well, I tried, but that's not for you. Or I can say, no, I'm actually going to try and stick at this and take that desert ultra marathon mindset into my everyday life. And that's why I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And like I said, there's never a perfect time. And I'd wanted to quit before, but there'd always been the next birthday or the wedding or your friends.
Yeah, very true. You just did so many different challenges again, like when you were doing your marathon, like you've got to ration your water and all of that. Those things in a different environment where you have to have the same mindset, like I've just got to keep going, get to my goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I knew I had to, you had to be organized. I had to communicate with people. I had to... You do have to, you know, to plan your day a bit. It's like, I know if I'm going to go around to my friend's house and my friend's the type of friend that's going to literally give me a drink as I walk through the door, I'm going to have to talk to them or I'm going to have to bring some alcohol-free alternatives. And it's different going through that journey again, because our society is so focused on alcohol. And it's funny, there were so many people that weren't worried about me when I was feeling really low and when I was drinking heavily. But as soon as I said, I've stopped drinking, the phone started ringing. People
saying,
are you okay? Are you okay? One person actually said to me, because I'd stopped drinking, do you need to go and speak to someone? They were like,
what?
They were like,
that's like the complete opposite thing that you think that they say.
I know. And they were like, we're worried about you. You're acting irrationally.
You're not Fun Freddy anymore.
Yeah, you're not Fun Freddy. They're like, you know, everyone was saying, okay, we've had a bit of a laugh now. You've done a couple of months alcohol free. Now, come on, stop playing, get back to yourself.
That culture's kind of bringing you back in, isn't it?
And I found a lot of people, actually, they were worried about their drinking, but that's what they liked having me around, because they knew if Freddie was there, then I'd always find myself in some fun situation, yeah. or there'd always be a funny story, or they could feel better about themselves drinking because they knew that I'd always have one more, or I'd never say no to a drink. And I'd never be the person that says,
no,
do you need
right.
to cut back a bit? Yeah, or I'm all right. And so all of a sudden, this person that I tried to make myself, he was gone, and people were worried
about
that.
And that's a hard transition
yeah.
for not, well, obviously you, but for everyone else. Like, yeah. you were the life and soul, as you I said, know, of the definitely. Party. So they've got to then look at their nights out completely differently.
Yeah, and it is like that. Mm. And I told myself that I could only be the life and soul of the party with alcohol in me. And it's, I think it's Dutch courage. It's getting an extra shot of confidence.
Yeah,
it's
liquid confidence yep, as well. Definitely. All those sayings.
It's all these things. And I had to change who I, well, not, I didn't have to change who I was, because I believe that we all have an identity, and that identity doesn't change. That is 100% who we are. It's the person that we are when we go to sleep, and it's the person that we are when we wake up. But the roles that we play, I think, are totally different. And
those
I,
are our choices we make.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's the mask that we wear, it's the characters we become. And I played all these roles for so long, the corporate worker who wasn't happy, or the party boy. But you know, to coin the song, I was saying, this is me. And,
yeah. Love it.
And it was scary. And, yeah. and I managed to get through a few months, and but then it did start to get easier. I did start to be able to change my habits, and I still had people saying to me, you know, are you okay? And some people do their alcohol-free journeys very publicly, and they put it straight on Facebook and they shout it from the rooftop.
Yeah, because they feel quite responsible, yeah, some people. Like, if definitely. I put it up on there, that means that I can't drink.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
but,
a reminder.
But for me, it was, I kept mine very quiet, and I think some people, certainly 95% of people don't know what I was feeling inside. And I'd say probably a good 50% of people that I don't see very regularly probably don't know how long I've gone alcohol free. And, but that was the way that I had to do it. And my other bit of advice would be, it doesn't really matter in terms of the method or the approach sometimes. The important thing is that it works for you.
It's like very true, yeah.
Like going through a desert, I could have, you know, I could have walked, I could have ran, I could have done it on my hands, but no one really cared as long as I got to my goal. Yeah, and made that achievement. And it's the same. So for me personally, I've only started talking about it very openly quite recently. At the time, I knew I had just to focus on me and maybe not hang out with certain people for a while. But that was okay, because I knew, I said, I wanted this life more than my old life.
So what is your life now?
My life is very different now. And yeah. I think a lot of that is through the alcohol-free confidence. And I wanted to be this person that was always proud and that had no regrets. And that's when things started to get more interesting, because obviously with my two boys, and I came back from the desert and I had the medals and did the talks and everything. And, you know, one day I was saying, you know, probably quite proud of myself. And I was like, you know, are you proud of your father, son? And they were like, no, daddy, we're bored of that now. In a lovely way
brutal.
That a five-year-old can say, like, brutal. I was like, but you know, I did the world's toughest ultra marathon. He was like, that was last year.
Yeah. And, what are you going to do now?
Well, yeah, the thing, and he got the Guinness Book of Records for Christmas, and he said, Daddy, I want you to break a Guinness World Record. And I said, right.
There's many. Records in there,
like,
you can pick.
Yeah, and he was like, well, you know, I was like, maybe I'll do like the longest Netflix record. And they said,
Daddy.
Yeah, I was like, I'd like that one. Yeah.
In the comfort zone.
Yes, absolutely.
70 million hours. I would love that.
I would, that'd be amazing. And yeah, he was saying, well, you know, you do a running one, Daddy, do a running one. I was like, okay, but I think I've done some decent running recently. Yeah. He was like, yeah, I don't care, do it.
You know, Sahara Desert, what can you top?
I know.
From that.
And he like, I think we were watching London Marathon TV with some of the people in fancy dress. And he was like, well, can't you do something in a costume? And I looked at the Guinness Book of Records, and all the fancy dress records are really tough. They're like, I think the fastest postman is...
Postman?
Yeah. You've got the fastest postman, you've got the fastest cheerleader, the fastest mermaid. But all these records were like under 3 hours. And
right.
I know I've run through a desert, but I can't run an under 3 hour marathon on the best of days. So I said, well, I can't do that. But then this one came up, the world's fastest fisherman. And my youngest, Luke, he was at the age of, he loved the sea, he loved fish,
yeah.
he loved fishing. And he was like, Daddy, you could be a fisherman. And I saw the time and it said 4 hours, 45 minutes. And I said, well, I'd run through the desert. That would be easy. I could do a 4-hour 45. Just dress as a fisherman, you know, carry a fishing rod. So I wrote off, didn't think much of it.
Yeah.
But then one day I got an email from the Guinness Book of Records saying, right, accepted. Attempt is on. I was like, right, I'd forgotten about that. But I thought, okay, fine, I can do that, just a marathon. And but then I read the instructions and it said had to be like a sea fisherman. So you had to wear bright yellow.
Very specific for the world records.
The Guinness World Records, tell you what, they are
a specific type of fisherman.
Yep. Specific type. So I had to wear like Deadliest Catch fisherman. So I had to wear
the full works.
Yep. Bright yellow, heavy plastic waterproofs, like jacket and trousers.
Oh my god.
Had to wear a hat. Had to be a yellow hat for some
reason.
Was
it striped? Do you have a stripy top on? I'm guessing that that's kind
of like
a fisherman.
I did. I think I actually had like a blue stripy top underneath.
Great.
Yeah. And I had to carry a 3-kilo fishing box. And I was like, well, that's
heavy.
A bit tough. Yeah. I was like, that's fine. But then I got to the bottom of the email and it said, the record attempt must be done wearing heavy rubber Wellington boots. I was like,
to
run
in those.
Yeah. And I believe me, because I looked into it. I couldn't put a pair of trainers in them. I couldn't put a slip a pair of Nike Airs or something
in
there somehow.
Can't
cheat. Because there were so many rules. I had to take a photograph of myself at every mile. We had to get witness statements. We had to send over 80 pieces of evidence to the Guinness Book of Records in terms of all this data to allow them to accept it. And so they took it really seriously. So that's where I found myself
going,
on the start
damn,
line.
I've got to do this.
On a hot May day in Liverpool, dressed like this, thinking,
super fisherman.
I've got to run a marathon in Wellies. And again, it would be lovely to say it was a tough challenge, but I managed it. From mile one, I knew I was in trouble.
Yeah.
And I saw my family and they were all there. And I gave them a quick hug and I kind of whispered to my wife, like, this isn't looking good. And apparently as soon as I ran off, they all just were planning for me to fail. And they all knew that I wasn't going to make it.
So your mindset was completely different.
Yeah, it was different. And I say about 13 miles in, my toenails started falling off. In 20 miles in, you know what it's like when, you know, when you're a kid and you get like, and you go to the seaside and you get water in your welly boots.
Yeah.
And it's all squelchy and squashy. Well, that was happening to my boots, but I realised it was blood.
Oh no! And I thought you were going to say sweat.
No,
figuring that would be sweat.
Yeah, it turned out it was blood because the back of my heels had fallen off. And
my gosh, I can't imagine that.
And I was looking at my watch and I was trying to work out because I was so hot as well and dehydrated and I was trying to work out my timings. I spent the last hour thinking that I'd failed. I was staggering along and then just with about 10 meters to go towards the finish line, I felt myself fainting and
Oh my god.
Like my whole world, my vision went black and white and you get that roaring in your ears.
Yeah, that ringing.
Your mouth gets all like moist. You think, oh, I'm either going to be sick or I'm going to faint. And I felt myself starting to drop down to the floor and I put my hand out to steady myself. And then this little hand grabbed my palm and it was my oldest boy.
Oh.
And he jumped over the barriers and he grabbed onto my hand and he said, come on, daddy, you haven't quit yet. You haven't. He said something like, you haven't come this far to only get this far, which I thought was quite intelligent.
That is
like
very intelligent.
It's like, you've been reading my books,
haven't you?
He said
exactly the right thing.
Yeah, and he said exactly what I needed. And my other youngest one joined me as well. And so together, we all crossed the finish line.
Oh, that's
and
wonderful.
I fell to my knees and then the whole...
Again, like
I know,
crying,
yeah, and I was literally crying. And they checked the time and I'd broken the record by 7 minutes. And I'd done it and that was it, and I'd become a world record holder.
Thank you so much, Freddie. That was absolutely amazing.
That's all right. Hopefully I didn't go on for too long. And
when I
get in my conquer zone, I tend to talk for a little while. But I say hopefully it's just about... It's trying to help people and it's making people realise that they can achieve anything that's possible. Think of me as like a TK Maxx or a Home Bargains version of like the SAS Who Dares Wins guys or David Goggins. Yeah.
You've definitely reeled us in, Freddie.
Very good.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks so much for listening, folks. This has been the Keep Real podcast. Make sure you subscribe. And Freddie, you've got a podcast too.
So if people want to hear more about my journey, they can follow me on Instagram at Freddie Explores. That's FREDDIE Explores, as in explores. And yeah, as part of my alcohol-free journey, I'm also now the co-host of what we're hoping is the world's most loved alcohol-free podcast, where we talk
Amazing.
About all things alcohol-free. And it's not judgmental. It's not alcohol being bad or evil. It's just saying, if you want to live your best life, here's a very light-hearted, open and honest, and quite, well, some people say it's hilarious, but I think people laugh at me, not with me. But yeah, so it's Over the Influence, which is, yeah, an exciting podcast and helping people to think differently about alcohol.
Fantastic, Freddie. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been good fun.